Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today nearly live. We are in Ottawa, Ontario, where we have the first installment of our first ever two-part episode here on the podcast. As a couple of weeks ago, there was a really interesting event over at the Canadian Museum of History. It was the Celebrating Canada Workshop and Public Roundtable. And that project is spearheaded by Matthew Hayday of the University of Guelph and Raymond Blake of the University of Regina. And the project, I'll read this from the website, aims to reflect on the political, social, and cultural forces that have shaped Canada over the course of its history. National holidays and commemorative events provide an intriguing window into how these processes have affected and continue to shape nationalism, culture, and identity politics. So in today's episode, I talk with Matthew Hayday, Marc-André Gagnon, and Robert Talbot about the overall purpose of this event, the roundtable, as well as the workshop, and some of the broader ideas that shape national holidays and commemoration. And if you're listening to this on the day we're releasing it, it's October the 29th. If you come back on Friday, October the 31st, we will have the audio of the public roundtable, which was chaired by Matthew Hayday and featured Yves Renette, Marc-André Gagnon, Mark Christmanson, and Robert Talbot. And then next Wednesday, which is November the 5th, we're running another History Slam episode, the second installment in this two-part episode, in which I headed over to the Canadian Museum of History and chatted with some of the participants in the workshop. So we get a sort of varied idea of what is going on as part of this project and what you can expect to see in the edited volume once it comes out in a few years.
And with us right now, though, we have Matthew Hayday from the University of Guelph, who is the co-editor of the Celebrating Canada Collection. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Marc-André Gagnon, a PhD candidate from the University of Guelph. He studies St. Jean-Baptiste. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And Robert Talbot, a Shirk postdoc at the University of New Brunswick, and his book is Negotiating the Numbered Treaties, an Intellectual and Political Biography of Alexander Morris, which has won some awards and is well respected. And welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
This is really interesting. We have three University of Ottawa alums here, back at the University of Ottawa, whereas I'm the current person here who hopes to be an alum someday. So welcome back, gentlemen. So first off, Matthew, I guess we'll start with you as the co-editor, as one of the people who's put this together. Where did this event come from? What was the motivation behind putting this on?
This has been in the works for, I would say, probably about 2 years now. Raymond Blake, who is my co-editor at the University of Regina, and I have been working on various aspects related specifically to Dominion Day and Canada Day celebrations through our own research. Both of us have published articles on it, never got a book out of it so far. It's been article-length projects. And both of us thought that really the timing was good with the 150th anniversary of Confederation coming up to try to pull together some bigger project to capitalize on commemoration fever, effectively. And so we put our heads together and decided that a collected volume might be a good way of doing it, casting our net larger than just Canada Day and Dominion Day to the wide array of different types of holidays that you have in Canada, but also the big anniversary commemorative events. So with that in mind, call for papers went out. We got interest from people, or a shocking amount of interest from people across the country in July. So one edited volume swelled to two. We decided to apply for a Shirk grant so that we could actually really bring everyone together to talk about these issues. And as part of putting that together and working with people at the museum, this has blossomed into a wider public outreach. So we're really excited about it.
Well, how many people do you have coming then?
We've got 36 people coming to the workshop itself, and I think there's slightly over 40 when you count co-authors and the couple of people who weren't actually able to make it to Ottawa this weekend.
So that is a pretty big group.
It's a pretty large undertaking.
And has it been difficult to sort of corral everybody and sort of keep everyone on track? I know that academics, there's a reputation that it's hard to...
The phrase I have always liked and I continue to use is herding cats.
Yeah.
So there's been some cajoling and bribing and... False deadlines, which I can admit to now that I managed to get the papers in finally for the workshop. But we did manage to get almost everybody in. I had a few people I had to pull out for personal reasons, but it's a pretty solid group of papers at this point. So.
And Marc-André, for you, as sort of the junior member, at least of the people here right now.
Thanks for mentioning it.
I think that's a badge of honor that you've been sort of welcomed into this event as a junior member. I mean, what's it been like for you to be part of this project?
Well, like when you deal with Canadian history and you're dealing with a pluralistic society, you're dealing with a lot of memories, which include local, regional, but also national memories. And I see my contribution to this roundtable or workshop as one which will bring the point of view of the civil society in Quebec, mostly from nationalistic voices. So what I try to see in my project is to see how the state and civil society reacted at some point in making the Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day La Fête Nationale des Québécois, which occurred in the mid-1970s. So my contribution will be to ask questions about what's about the states in commemoration. What are the resources mobilized? What are the discourses? What are kind of reaction you have to expect from civil society, especially nationalist leader for the case of Quebec? Comparing also what happened in Quebec with what happened in Canada, and Matthew here could talk about it because, as he said, he worked on this about this issue. So that's how I see my contribution. Hmm.
If I could sleep in, I think one of the really interesting things about what Marc-André is doing and why I really wanted to make sure he was part of this is that you do have this period of rival national holidays that starts emerging from almost, I would say, even the late 60s onwards.
Yeah.
It's even in the Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day period that Dominion Day or Canada Day and Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day or La Fête Nationale are separated by a week. And they both are trying to position themselves as national holidays. So there's this real competing nationalisms and competing.
And you are at this point where Canadian and Quebecois identity are reforming themselves. So that's pretty interesting conjuncture.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's a constant tension within commemorations and celebrations more broadly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I know I taught a course on pop culture this year, and so I used your stuff on Canada Day with representations of First Nations people on Parliament Hill in Canada Day. So I used that in my course, and I've studied briefly the switch from Dominion Day to Canada Day, the legislative switch, and how they didn't have quorum and nobody was really there.
Speaking of the hot Friday afternoon in July.
And then they take leave to celebrate what they just did. But that tension that's really interesting, especially with Saint-Jean-Baptiste, how they are, you know, the 24th and then July 1st. So it is a week apart. And there is a really interesting tension. And I don't know if that's more in Quebec than elsewhere in the country where that's more prominent. But it's a really interesting debate and discussion, I find. Mm-hmm. But before we really delve into this, first, well, Robert, we need to get you in this. How do you fit in then to this debate, this discussion?
Well, I'm doing, like Matthew said, there's a great diversity of papers, I think, that are involved in this project. You have, your Canada Day, Dominion Day, and then Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day. There's also more localized celebrations that are being represented in some of these papers, also manifestations of protest against different kinds of ways that the nation has been projected or celebrated. And my paper is actually just deals with Canada Day, but I think what will be interesting in looking over some of the drafts for these papers is some of the what I can incorporate into my own work and how my work relates to those papers. What I've looked at specifically is sort of the first kind of big Dominion Day, I guess, that was celebrated, and that was the Diamond Jubilee of Confederation in 1927. There had been a celebration in 1917, the 50th anniversary of Confederation, but it was somewhat muted because, of course, there was a war going on, you know, that we've all heard of, and that we'll be
hearing a lot more of in the couple of years to come.
Yeah, we'll be hearing more about that, I'm sure. So there was a war going on in 1917. There was a little thing called the conscription crisis that was brewing. So there were different views of what Canada was, what its place in the world was, and there was not a lot of agreement. So celebrations were somewhat muted in 1917. So 1927, Mackenzie King and the Liberals say, okay, here's an opportunity to, let's try this over. We'll have a restart. We'll have a new big celebration, a big bash. And it was kind of the first big Dominion Day. And among other things, one of the important things and themes that came out of this and that surprised me and that I focused on is bilingualism and biculturalism, something that you wouldn't necessarily expect in 1927. Of course, the Official Languages Act is 40 years distant. So I'm discussing that paper in this collection, but what's interesting, I think, is some of the themes that come out, this question of sort of bilingualism and biculturalism, you know, and how far do we take that? Those emerge in the coming decades. Again, of course, in 67, and then later on, with the tension we were talking about between Canada Day / Dominion Day and Saint-Jean-Baptiste, or La Fête Nationale, these different notions of what Canada is, and that sort of, that contest that's going on.
And that 1927 celebration is interesting to me because I've studied it in the context of radio, and that was the first national radio broadcast. So I mean, so for me, I'm not looking at it as a national celebration, more of like the progress of radio and how it affects that. But it's a really interesting event in that context.
Yeah, and that's a big part of it. Sort of the two work together. The sort of the very first transnational radio broadcast, the first coast-to-coast radio broadcast in Canadian history. So it was this technological innovation that came about, but it also became a huge point of pride, as I'm sure you know, you came across in your research, that, hey, look at us, we're Canadian, and you know what? One of the things that's cool about us is we've got all the latest technology. We've got radio, you know, from coast to coast, and so that the, in a way, you know, the medium became part of the message. You know, here we are, a modern progressive country. We've got coast to coast radio, among other things. Yeah.
And this is something that crops up again at various points in the history of how these events are celebrated, that technology in the media becomes the way of bridging geography. When John Diefenbaker decides that he wants to revive these big celebrations in 1958, it's with a simulcast television broadcast of the Governor General's message. And then in 1977, when there's the panic about Quebec separatism, it's the coast-to-coast broadcast on basically every television and radio station in the country using the new Annex satellite technology. So we've gone into space now. So there is definitely this connection that's a common thread through all of this.
Yeah, for sure. And it's a big theme. It's a big point of pride. And I think one of the reasons why 1927 was one of the first big bashes was because it was more possible because of the technology that was available, to do that.
Yeah, and I think you see that too. And when they do like the Empire broadcast at Christmas all the time for the CBC, and that was a big deal. And then they do a concert in 1937, and they hold Canada up as a modern nation and try to unite people through this technology.
Yeah.
And say, look at us, we're great, we're progressive, and all that. And that's a major marketing feature of the CBC in its early years. And so, it's an interesting dynamic at play.
And if I may add, when you come to the Saint-Jean-Baptiste in the 1960s, independentists or the IRN will play the fact that parades in Montreal in 68, 69 are going on the air, on television, to disturb it, to pass their message. So the medium become also important for civil society leaders or political party leaders for this particular case, to make people aware of their existence and that they are using the celebration as a tremplin towards what they are advocating.
And I guess that's how we get to with TV. We get that moment, you know, Trudeau up on the stage.
Exactly.
There,
it becomes a political stance for both.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, a platform for both sides, I guess, to convey a message. Yeah.
Well, and this speaks, I don't want to step on your foot with questions, but this speaks to what I think is going to be one of the big themes as moderator I'm hoping to tease out of the roundtable this evening is the extent to which these celebrations and commemorations have always been political in some ways, that there are always different groups trying to advance their political agendas or their social agendas through these celebrations and contesting them. So I guess one of the questions that we might get into this evening, I'm not sure how well that'll play out, is there anything different about what is going on in contemporary politics of how celebrations and commemorations are being used, or is this just more of the same? I'm curious to know what my panelists in the audience is going to have to say.
Well, that leads me to a question in terms of this contested ground with the different people trying to get their voice heard through these celebrations. And I was on a road trip with my parents recently, and we were going along, and my dad loves historical plaques. If there's a historical plaque, he'll go read it. And awesome. Which it's great, and we make fun of him for it, because it doesn't matter what it is, he's going to read it. But we were talking about this notion of a contested terrain in history, and he said, well, that plaque just said, this is what happened on this date. So there's nothing political about that. And I said, but there is. Like, you got like, why is it here? Why did they pick that event and this and all this stuff? And so we're trying to explain that. So what I'm wondering is, if we're studying a national celebration, is it possible to even have a national celebration given that these things are so contested?
Well, I think that you can certainly make the effort to have it be a national celebration. I think the nation itself, I think Benedict Anderson, who gets trotted out every time this topic is talked about, said it right, that it's an imagined community. And there is this constant process of trying to foster this collective imagination and have people buy into it. And not everyone is going to all the time. So it's a question of degree, I think, of to what extent you're successful of having people believe in the vision that is being put forward, to have them participate in it through those celebrations and commemorations, to really get that citizen buy-in. And we've seen at different points in history, certainly throughout the collection, that we've got papers on everything from Aboriginal contestation, French-Canadian contestation, competing visions between British-Canadian and the more Canadian-Canadian, if I can put that in scare quotes, version of identity, visions of the flag and what that means for nationalism. We've got a really interesting paper from a Chinese scholar about how there was an effort to in the 1920s to contest Dominion Day by holding counter demonstrations for a Chinese humiliation day in protest against the Chinese Exclusion Act. So there is going to be dissent. I think that no matter what you do, there will be dissent. Mm-hmm. Some group will say, "Well, no, you know, I consider myself part of the nation, and that's not my celebration." Mm-hmm. There will be varying degrees of buy-in from year to year, and depending on how you couch it and depending on how much input and participation there is in terms of how these celebrations are set up.
But could that subversiveness, and let's say the Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day, to a certain extent, at least in a separatist sense, these people are trying to be subversive of what Canada Day is all about, right? And or at least trying to sort of take away from what people who are saying Canada Day, or national celebration. Well, Saint-Jean-Baptiste people are saying, well, no, not so much, because you're not including us in that celebration. But does not these competing part then all sort of work together to explain what the nation is? And that people who are trying to take away from a singular national narrative are actually contributing to what the nation actually is?
Possibly. I mean, it's dependent on what is your sociological reference. Most of Quebecers are considering themselves Quebecers first. So it's true that for them, the national holiday will be, for example, La Fête Nationale du Québec. But it's true that when you're dealing with Francophones in Canada, you're not only dealing with Quebec, you're dealing with Francophones outside Quebec, which, for example, Acadians have their own national day. And in other parts of Canada, people are still celebrating the Saint-Jean-Baptiste. And another fashion that Quebec is celebrating is Fête Nationale. So for Francophones outside Quebec, Saint-Jean-Baptiste still represents this dialogue between communities, while in Quebec, it's more part of the nation-building process. So even at this level, when you try to say that there's maybe a competition between the two, there's also a competition within the Saint-Jean-Baptiste or the Fête Nationale to express another dimension of Francophone Canada. So that's what I would add to the discussion.
Yeah, you have all sorts of contested meaning between, even within what we might call regional or think of as regional celebrations, like Marc-André said, Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day historically was a French-Canadian national holiday for Francophones, whether you're from St. Boniface, whether you're from Quebec, or whether you're from Northern Alberta. This was the national holiday, and it's still celebrated by Francophones outside Quebec. And it also used to be a much more religious holiday as well, and that religious connotation exists to some degree with maybe some in some Francophones outside Quebec. And so I think all of these things, if you try, you become there will always be sort of dissent, and these things will remain contested. I think whether it's you think of the big pan-Canadian celebration or a more regional or local celebration.
If I can get back to what I think was a different piece of this question you were asking, as well as whether that contestation is part of what makes Canada Canada, mm-hmm. is this this yeah. constant interplay and the willingness to contest and to accept that there will be contestation, which I personally tend to like. I think that is part of what makes up what makes up Canada.
Yeah.
And I think that you've had more successful celebrations and commemorations when there's been a willingness to admit the diverse interpretations and to let the different groups
yeah.
be part of it in some form or another. And we've got some papers in the collection that deal with centennial celebrations in Saskatchewan, for example, that talk about how Aboriginal descent was part of how mm-hmm. they set it up, and that was a successful feature. But I'm not, and this is where I get into more editorializing, I would say that there's certainly, I would definitely say in the current government, I would say other governments as well don't like the messiness that academics are a little bit more willing to accept mm-hmm. about our history, that we're like, well, history is a great big mess, but isn't that wonderful? And it shows, you know, the many voices of our society and the diversity. Other people like the clean, straightforward mm-hmm. march of progress towards a fixed, coherent identity narrative, and don't like having to come up with messaging and publicity materials that celebrate and embrace the trouble, for want of a better term.
Well, this event is happening at the newly renamed Canadian Museum of History.
Yes.
A lot of these questions or issues were raised when that decision to rename it the Canadian Museum of History was announced, and there were meetings across the country where people could come in and express their displeasure, support, whatever, for that decision. And for a lot of people, it was part of this, again, this government's, the way they are commemorating things. And I'm wondering, for you guys who are part of this workshop, how much of this event is then political in pointing out some of the flaws of how this government is working with its commemorations? I know Yves Fournette is on this work, or on the roundtable tonight. He's been on the show before, talking about his article, discussing this particular government's use of history. Is that any part of the motivation for what you're doing?
I was, since I'm the one who set up the roundtable, I'll let the other two say whether they intend to get political tonight, which they're more than free to do. I tend to see myself as sort of moderate in the history wars, and indeed in the commemoration wars, that I see there being problems with what the current government does, but when people get really riled up about it, I also like to be the person who says, like, well, yeah, the Conservatives are creating a memory narrative, and they're trying to get their message through Canadian heritage mm-hmm. and so forth. But on the other hand, so did the Liberals.
Yeah,
like, this is part of what Trudeau did. This
they're
is part of what Pearson did.
Last,
yeah. You know, Chrétien had his whole shtick that he tried to get through. And so I'm trying to bring some balance into that, and perhaps through the discussion get a sense of what is different in terms of degree or the specifics of the content, but also try to get forth the other side of it, that there is continuity in certain ways
mm-hmm.
as well, and people
yeah.
need to see that. And I haven't actually had a chance to speak to him before the roundtable. I've given him the questions, but we do have the chief executive officer of the National Capital Commission, Mark Christmanson,
mm-hmm.
who's going to be part of this as
yeah.
well. So he's the on-the-ground person who actually puts these,
mm-hmm.
or certainly his people, put these events on here.
Yeah.
And I think he'll have a very interesting take, and will have spoken to the people who work with him
mm-hmm.
to give us the sense of the longer duration of what this is like for people who actually work in the field.
It'll be interesting to see. I'm interested to hear what he has to say, because the NCC lost Canada Day. Now that's with the Ministry of Heritage. So it'll be interesting to see if he's maybe a little more open about Canada Day now that it's not under his jurisdiction.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But
although that's a back-and-forth process as well.
Yeah.
They may have lost Canada Day, but it was dumped on them in the
80s yeah.
because it was Secretary of State and the CBC that did it. And then at a certain point they were like, yeah, we're not really going to be in the business of this for a while, and it got relegated to a local affair under the NCC back then. So even here, there's a back and forth. This isn't, you know, strictly a story of centralization
mm-hmm.
in some respects.
Now, the last thing, because we've already gone over time for how long I'm going to keep you guys, but so with respect to this, the way these things are contested, it strikes me as this is somewhat new in the historiography, and I knew like within the last 20 years. Because when I was an undergrad, it's not something we really talked about that much, how history is really all that contested. In the historiography stuff I did, it was more about methods and schools of thought and all this. But now we're getting into this notion of commemoration and how these things are really contested. And is doing a workshop and a public roundtable like this a way to maybe inform people and really demonstrate people who aren't in history how contested these issues really are and how critical they need to be when consuming any history?
Yeah, I think it's very important to communicate that to people. I mean, when we're told that the War of 1812 was Canada's War of Independence, you know, I think sometimes people might be tempted to take that at face value, that, yeah, we beat the Americans and that established Canada in 1812. But I think it's important to bring a different perspective to say that history is more complicated than that. But that's not a bad thing. It just means it's more interesting. There are more perspectives that we can explore and that need to be represented. So I think it's important to maintain that contact between academia and the public, because otherwise history, Canadian history or popular Canadian history, will be written by a very few people who might have their own, I guess, narrative in mind that they want to project.
Well, speaking for the historiography, it was pretty in development at the end of the 1990s and the beginning of 2000 when you saw all those issues like Ronald Rudin, Nellis, Alan Gordon on commemoration. But what's interesting right now is that we are a couple of years prior of 2017, which will be the 150th anniversary of Confederation. So thinking about these questions right now, with all which can happen in the next few years, I think will be interesting for people to see that what it's expecting to happen in 2017 and committees have been put together and ideas are flowing. So it's not the work of someone which starts 6 months prior of the event. It's a long-term process. Mm-hmm. And as I said, we are a couple of years ahead, so having a collection like that which can look at how it happened before, what kind of messages were on display, how do you mobilize some values, let's say, about gender or Aboriginal people in these, and how it is transformed through time, I think will be useful for the 2017 celebrations.
There's already banners up all over this city. I'm sure you've noticed them, Robert, because you live here, but I don't know if you guys have seen them since you've been in town, but there's banners on City Hall and other municipal buildings, and I think some federal buildings, that say Ottawa 2017, be here for the celebration.
Get ready. We don't know what's happening.
Something big is happening.
It's going to be huge.
Yeah. No. Well, and I think that when you have these big commemorative events and the anniversaries, it's a fantastic teaching moment for people in the Academy to reach out and to give the public the benefit of our expertise. I think that historians are actually pretty good at doing this. I know we were criticized over the course of the summer. Richard Gwynn lambasted us and said, you know, there's only two public academics in Canada. And it's like, wow, you are you're in a different bubble world from the one that I'm living in. Like, I've got 40 people who are coming to Ottawa who are all interested in these questions. Yeah. So
clearly he doesn't listen to this show.
Apparently not.
If you're listening, Richard.
Sean would like to do an interview with you.
Yeah, come on the show. We can talk about it. I know I said that was the last question. This one will actually be the last question. Robert, you mentioned popular history and again, reaching out to the public. And it strikes me, though, that the stuff that sells, and frankly, the stuff that I find more entertaining to read, and if the public is buying books, usually to be entertained, it's stuff with a singular narrative that's easy, that you can just follow. So how then do we make these sort of contested things that are a little more messy, a little more nuanced, how do we make those popular that can be easily consumed by a general audience?
You can write narrative history. You can write, and sometimes that makes for a compelling story, the history from the perspective of one person or from a group of individuals. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I'm a big fan of biographical history, you know, and sometimes that reads easily because you're following the life of one person. But I think you can still, within that, you can still acknowledge that there are different perspectives that are out there. And maybe, instead of always having a book from the perspective of a dead white guy. You know, of course, that's what I did. But it's okay to there are compelling stories of women or of ethnocultural people who come from an ethnocultural minority or Aboriginal individuals. One of the there's a really popular a book that came out that was kind of mixed history with fiction, which was about Francis Pegamobo, the sniper from the first World War. That was inspired by his story. So I think there are opportunities out there to make that different perspectives popular in literature.
There is definitely a tension in the academy about what you publish, and that the academic monograph with the university press is what's going to get you tenure and what's going to get you promoted, and the popular history that you do with Penguin isn't going to count for nearly as much. So I think there is that strain, especially on younger academics, that they're trying to focus on the one piece, which often is not the easily consumable piece. But I think one of the ways you get around that is you think in terms of, okay, what is my scholarly book? And then what are these separate pieces that I can do for public outreach that are more easily condensed? So thinking in terms, I know people who are writing op-eds for major newspapers like the Ottawa Citizen, which is always looking for these types of pieces, and the Montreal Gazette, that if you think in terms of, well, I'm writing this book, but I'm also going to do this newspaper piece, and I'm going to reach out to a journalist who might be interested in doing a story to try and get the snippets and the interesting stories out in a more condensed, easily accessible fashion is not a bad way of getting around that issue. But also that once you get to the point in your career where you can write the popular book, to write the popular book, because why not? That's, I think there needs to be a bit more of that once people have the security in their career to actually then be taking that step.
Or even stuff for like active history. I know, I mean, Marc-André, we worked together on your piece.
Sure.
I sort of edited it for you, and you wrote that terrific piece on Saint-Jean-Baptiste. So, I mean, these sort of outlets are there. The concern I have is that how wide is it, and what exactly is the audience, and is it simply a matter of preaching to the converted sort of thing? It would be my question, and that's the sort of thing. I have no idea what the audience for this show is. I will freely admit it. I don't know how many people listen, and I don't know who listens, except for the people who tell me that they have listened. So I know there's like 10 people who listen on a semi-regular basis. But other than that, I have no idea. And I think that's a failure on my part in the way I do this, is that I think I need to be more focused on how I target the show and to whom I target it to. And I think that's a tension that we would all feel. Anyone who is involved in academics at any level who wants to do public outreach is, you know, we're so used to tailoring ourselves to an academic market. How do we shift?
Yeah.
And even just on a pragmatic level, how do I write for a non-academic audience when my whole training has been towards an academic?
That's audience? These are big, big questions that you open up, and you even just. I think Matthew makes a really good point about even just reaching out with an editorial or to a newspaper. I mean, they're always looking for free content. You
know,
They're not going to pay you to do it.
But neither do the academic journals. You know?
No, that's also
true.
Very true, yeah.
And you're right, and I think there needs to be a shift in how we think about that, and maybe we need to do more to acknowledge the work that people are doing in that. And if I could put a plug... I'm one of the co-editors of the Canadian Historical Association Bulletin, and we have a page at the end, Historians and News, where we try to kind of quickly acknowledge people who've been doing that kind of thing. You know, this person wrote an op-ed, this person contributed another piece to a journal or to a newspaper. So we try to acknowledge that in a small way, but I think more broadly there needs to be, these things need to count on your resume more, or need to be seen as counting more than maybe they do. And in terms of how we write, you're right, we've been trained to write a certain way. One of the good advice I had in terms of if you want to make your writing more accessible and enjoyable is make sure, obviously, you're reading the historiography, you're reading good history, but also read good fiction, just to improve your prose, so to speak, that can help with it too.
I think that was actually, to pull things back to your comment about us all being Ottawa U people, I think it was actually Don Davis who was giving that advice out very freely, who is now Professor Emeritus here.
Yes.
So.
Yes, his cup is still, his mug that says Don on it, is awarded annually to the trivia winner in March. And
came this close to winning it one year.
We put all, in the spring, maybe it was a year and a half ago, we put all the names of the people who won, who we could remember, on little plaques on the bottom of it. It was mounted. It's actually looks pretty good, although I would never in a million years drink out of it. It does look pretty good. So guys, thanks so much for doing this. Matthew Hayday, Marc-André Gagnon from the University of Guelph, Robert Talbot with the University of New Brunswick. Thanks a lot, guys. Good luck this weekend, and we'll see you tomorrow where we talk to some of the participants.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just a reminder, if you come back on Friday, which is October the 31st, we will have the audio of the public roundtable from the Canadian Museum of History. And next Wednesday, November the 5th, we will have the second installment of our two-part episode in which I speak to some of the participants in the Celebrating Canada workshop. If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is at Dr. Shawnee Fever. And as always, if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.